Good evening. My name is Michael Berg. I'm an alcoholic.
Michael!
It's good to be here. I see a room full of diehard AA members. Or not football fans. Or people who could not get out of their commitment. Mark, thank you so much for inviting me up here. Full disclosure, Mark was kind enough this week when he confirmed me to kind of like let me off the hook if I wanted to reschedule, but I couldn't feel that disappointment from my sponsor, so I am here. It's great to be here. Thank you, Tracy, for your talk. Shelby, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I almost screwed everything up. And thank you, Shelby, for your talk. Gosh, even when I met you, I went Shelby Mustang, Shelby Mustang, Shelby Mustang. Her name is Shelby. Never works. It never works. You spoke about that peace of mind, and I think that's one of the greatest gifts that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is that peace of mind. Is that, you know, today I'm able to have that peace of mind, even when like my mind begins to run and things aren't going my way, and this is this and this is that and what is this, and I can stop. I have the tools. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the tools to go, oh, hold up, stop. And I have that peace of mind, and you know, by all means, it's the greatest gift I've been given. My sobriety date is November 26, 2009. It was Thanksgiving that year. I'm not a big proponent on you know, waiting a day or two before one gets sober. But if it falls on a holiday, you got to spend it with family and extended family. Have a drink. Because everybody was following me that day. When I would go into the bathroom, there would be a knock on the door. If I was in there, like, Michael, are you okay in there? You know, and little did I know I was going somewhere that night. But I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous 3 days later, and it's like you had been expecting me. It's like you had been waiting for me. You know, you had people greeting, extending their hands out at the door, welcoming me. You had people offering me coffee. Somebody took me to a seat that seemed like it was meant for me. And I got to tell you, you know, if you're new, welcome. We have been expecting you. We've been waiting for you. And we've been preparing this room for you to come in and sit down. My sponsor is a guy by the name of Carl Morris. He's very happy tonight, right now, and he's painfully aware at times that he is my sponsor. I remind him all the time. Some of my phone calls begin with him, hey, so you know how you're my sponsor. My home group is the Covina group, and our big meeting that we meet at, it's on a Sunday night. It's our Sunday night speaker meeting. Mark has been there before, and I love it. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love going to meetings. I was driving to a meeting a couple of months ago, and excited just going to a meeting, just sitting in and listening and participating. I love it. And it hit me. It's been a really long time that I've loved going to meetings. I remember like being new and sitting in meetings, just miserable, just hating this, just like hating everybody, hating you, and just miserable. And I, you know, the old timer would say, "You just keep going to meetings until you love going to meetings." And I'd be like, "That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. Like, who does that?" You know, and me, I do. You know, I love going to meetings, and I don't know when that occurred in my sobriety, but it's been a long time that I've loved going to meetings. So I love this. I don't care if it's Super Bowl Sunday, you know, a holiday or what. I love coming to meetings, and thank you. Thank you for keeping the lights on up here in Lancaster. I grew up in a very loving home. I have a sister, she's a couple years older than me, and my parents, they just, you know, they surrounded us with a lot of love, a lot of good, loving people went in our lives. My mom, she's a third generation Japanese American. Her mom and my bachan, my grandmother, she was interned during World War II in the Japanese internment camps. And my mom was a hippie in the 60s and 70s. She used to hitchhike from like Los Angeles up to San Francisco and go to all these free concerts in Golden Gate Park and things like that, where all the hippies were, you know. And my dad is a white guy who was a deacon of the Lutheran Church. Now I don't know, I'm not sure like how those two met, but their marriage is the result of a joint, a Bible, and the conception of my sister. I'm pretty sure it was that order too. And then growing up was always kind of weird in my house, because like on Saturday nights the hippie commune would come over and they'd all party, and on Sunday mornings we'd be in church, and we're Lutherans, so it's the type of church where the pastor just kind of stands up at the pulpit much like this and talks like this and says things like hallelujah and jubilee. Kind of like you're talking about like two words that are born out of like celebration and glee and all this stuff. And we Lutherans, we just, it's kind of like, you know, just talking to a junkie, you know, just kind of, you know. I mean, it would prepare me for later in life dealing with these things. But, you know, I got drunk for the first time when I was 12 years old. A friend of mine spent the night at my house, and we got into my parents' liquor cabinet, and we started taking swigs of vodka. And I don't remember this like great aha moment, right? Like the heavens didn't part for me that night. I didn't feel any taller. I didn't feel any cuter. I was cute enough as a 12-year-old, I feel like. But I was. I was really cute. These kind of like pretty little cheeks. But what I do remember from that night, what I remember so vividly from that night, was that there was this driving force behind that bottle. Like, I could not stop taking swigs of it. Now, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that you have up here, it tells me that I have this phenomenon of craving, that I have this allergy of the body, right? All right, so like, this is the only allergy I've got. I'm not allergic to cats, bee stings, or strawberries. And if I was allergic to any one of these things, I just wouldn't own a cat. I would avoid bees at all costs, and I certainly wouldn't eat strawberries. But there is this other part to this disease that we call alcoholism, and that's the obsession of the mind. And that's all those things that I tell myself that make it okay to pick up and take a drink, and no matter what happened to me last night, last week, or the month before. And the obsession of the mind, it's also that thing in me that's going to make it impossible for me to get comfortable sober. And before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and started working these 12 steps, like, those were two things that I've been trying to get to converge on my life at the same time. Like, I was either really comfortable, which meant I was really drunk, or I was sober. And that meant I was irritable, restless, and discontent. High school was pretty much just that for me. It was high. I have no other way of describing my high school career. My mother hates it when I describe it as that, but, you know. And I had, like, I had a lot of friends in high school, right? But I never, like, felt like I fit in. I never felt that connection with other people, right? Unless I was drinking. You know, you get two or three drinks in me, I fit in with everyone. I fit in with the freaks, the geeks, the jocks, and the sluts. I fit in with everybody, you know? And so by the time that I'm, like, you know, at 22 years old, I'm drinking in bars and nightclubs on a daily and nightly basis. And already what's happening at this time in my life, see, already I know, like, you know, when I go into a bar and I start drinking, or I go into a club and I start drinking, like, I know at this time in my life that I'm going to be either unavailable for the next 2 days, a week, a month. I just don't know which one it's going to be. And what's happening is exactly what the Big Book talks about, that I have lost the power of choice in drink. I was no longer in control. My mind was. It was just using my body as transportation to the next drink. Now, got to tell you, when you drink as much as I was, blackouts occur, and I had a lot of them. And like, I never came out of a blackout and, like, my taxes were done. Or my laundry was neatly folded and put away. No, I always came to out of blackouts and places and situations that I really didn't want to be in. I remember this one time I came out of a blackout and, like, I was completely naked in bed with a naked woman. And the only reason I wanted out of that situation is because I'm gay. And
Thank you.
I'm so glad you guys find that funny. I found it rather confusing that night. I thought I was. Maybe I'm not. Well, at least my dad's gonna be proud. I'll tell you, he was not proud. He was just as confused as I was. I just got used to this. Now you're this. It was an interesting day, I'll tell you that. You guys ever come out of a blackout and wish you can go back into it? Yeah, right? Like, you figure, like, okay, like, my blacked out mind got me into this mess, it can get us out of it. You know? So you kind of close your eyes and squeeze. You know? I remember one time I come out of this blackout and I'm driving my car. It's 3:30 in the morning, and I'm somewhere in South Central LA, and there's a bum in my car putting cologne on, and I slam on the brake. I get him out of the car. You know, I'm just like, I don't know. To this day, I don't know if like he was giving me directions to the freeway, if you know we were gonna go score some crack, or if money was about to be exchanged for sex. I don't. But any one of those things is possible in my life back then. I got into this relationship with this guy who was going to law school, and just right off the bat, he hated my drinking. You know, he noticed it was different, and he did not like it, and. So we got engaged. And like, I would do things like I would hide little bottles of booze and flasks all throughout the apartment. He would go through, he would find them, he would dump them out. It was this really sick and toxic game of hide and seek that nobody won. And I would start fights with him on purpose, because when we fought, he would make me sleep on the couch. And he never found that one bottle of vodka that he used to hide underneath the couch, you know? And so this one night, I just wanted to drink. And so I started this fight with him, and we're going back and forth. And now he's presenting arguments with points A, B, and C. So those law classes are really starting to pay off. And he grabs his pillow and a blanket and storms out of the room. I'm like, where are you going? He goes, I'm sleeping on the couch tonight. And I'm like, wait a second. Let's work this out tonight. And we didn't. And he falls asleep on the couch. So now I'm like pacing in the room. And like at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm doing a SEAL Team 6 crawl across the living room floor. And I got my arm all the way underneath the couch. And I'm like, somewhere under here. So maybe it's to the back. And he goes, I threw it away. Now go to bed. And I'm like, no. Should have started this search an hour earlier. There was this one night that we were just having this really nice night. We had made dinner. We were going to watch a movie later, we're doing the dishes and I'm thinking to myself, man, I'm doing so great. Like, I haven't had a drink. I haven't thought about a drink. Like, I'm doing so good. And then as we're doing the dishes, like that next thought comes in, goes, you know what, Michael, you are doing good. And I'm like, duh, I just said that, you know? And it's like, popcorn, you deserve a drink. Let's go get popcorn. And I'm like, okay, yeah, let's go get, you know? And I'm like, babe, I'll be right back. I'm going to go get some popcorn. I'll be right back for the movie, right? You know? And so I went down the grid. Now, the bar that I used to drink at, it used to be in the same shopping center as, the grocery store. So I was going to just run into the bar, take a quick shot, run to the grocery store, get some popcorn. I'd be home in like 3 minutes tops. And I run to the bar. I'm like, quick, give me a shot. And took a shot. And I look at my watch and I'm like, oh my God, in 90 seconds. Give me one more shot. Just one more minute. Take another shot. And we're like, now we're at like, 2 minutes and some change. And I'm like, I'll just say there was like one check stand open, long line, one more shot. Got home around 3:30 in the morning. The bedroom door was locked, which is nothing new in our relationship, and I just passed out on the couch. And the next morning I came to, and And I walk into the kitchen. I stumbled into the kitchen a little bit, and there he was, you know, sitting at the kitchen table, you know, with that look in his face. It's just that disgusted look in his face, and he's shaking his head and goes, "How could you do this? How could you? You promised you would never do this again. How could you do this again?" And I don't know if I was just. If I was just too tired, too hungover, just out of excuses, but for some reason that morning I told him the truth. And the truth is, I don't know. I don't know. Because I don't know. I don't know why when I take a drink, I'm dying to have another drink. And when I'm not drinking, all I'm thinking about is drinking again. I'm not going to know these things until I come to you guys and you take me through the doctor's opinion and you teach me about the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. But until then, it's just any number of excuses that I can come up with. Or for some strange reason, that morning, the truth. He told me that morning that it's either him or the booze. And just like that, I said, then you got to go. You got to go. Because, like, make no mistake, if you get in the way of me and my booze, it's you that has to go and not the booze. But I probably should have thought about that a little bit longer because he's now an attorney for Google. Oat is right, yeah. Because that would have been a sweet divorce. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. I could have a beach house. You guys are sick. You guys are sick. I love you. Oh, man. I moved out to the San Fernando Valley shortly after that. I was able to drink the way that I wanted to drink. I was off a leash. Nobody was. I no longer had to control and enjoy my drink. I could just enjoy my drinking, and I did. I began to get arrested, and over the course of 3 years, you know, I'd be arrested about a dozen or so times. Those days and nights that I would be in jail, those would be the only days and nights that I would draw a sober breath. I was never far from a drink or anything that affected me from the neck up. And so by the summer of 2009, my powerlessness and unmanageability has led me to the streets of Los Angeles. I'm now doing everything that I need to do to survive on the streets of Hollywood. And what's happening at this time in my life is exactly what Dr. Silkworth talks about in the doctor's opinion. That after a time, we cannot differentiate the truth from the false. Because the truth in my life is simply this. I'm powerless over alcohol, and my life is unmanageable. And the false is just that lie that I tell myself, which is I could stop this whenever I want to. I just don't want to. And so by now, this time, like, you know, I'm turning tricks in a motel parking lot, but my life is so unmanageable, I can't even show up for work. You know, nobody likes an escort that doesn't show up for work. You know. Not really a good business model, you know what I'm saying? You are giving me life over here. I love you. And so by October of 2009, you know, I'm arrested once again, and once again I'm up in front of that judge, and once again that judge is reading me charges, and he violates my probation again. You know, and I kind of rolled my eyes. I must have had some reaction like that because he said, "You know what? I'm sick of you." He threw my folder across his table and he started to sentence me to a year in jail. And he stopped. He stopped mid-sentence and he says, "You know what? I'll let you serve your time if you go to a sober living." All right. So like this is a new phrase I've heard. Right? Like. These are two words that I've never heard spoken side by side each other before, right? This sober living, okay? Like, okay, living, okay, I get it. All I'm doing at this time in my life is existing, right? But sober. Sober. I mean, the only thing that I know about sobriety is that it's an absolute nightmare. I mean, you take alcohol and drugs away from me, and it's like you're holding me underwater, and I can't breathe. And I need to breathe. I need to survive. I need to drink. And that judge gave me 30 days to be checked into a sober living and be back in his courtroom clean and sober, so he'd put me in jail for a year. And over the course of the next 30 days, I'd come to know the cunning, baffling, and powerful nature of this disease that we call alcoholism. And that's the baffling nature of drinking while trying so desperately hard not to drink, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. And on November 25th of 2009, my sister, she found me on the streets of Hollywood, and she took me to sober living. And I'm so grateful that Sober Living's primary purpose was to drop us off in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous and show us how to do it. Now, I would love to have made this drive all the way up to Lancaster and stand before you tonight and tell you that I just launched it in this course of rigorous action. But I didn't. I just sat in the back of meetings with my arms folded, just looking at the ground, it's just like, this isn't going to work for me, and I'm shaking my head constantly, and every now and then, I'd hear something, and I'd perk up a little bit. I remember I'm at this meeting, I'm 30 days sober, and this guy sitting right behind me starts sharing, right? And he starts sharing about that voice in his head. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, there are crazy people here in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And they'll talk about it too. And he goes, and then he starts saying, and you have that voice too. And I'm like, okay, this guy's especially great. Who has a voice in their head, talks about having a voice in their head, and then says that everybody else has a voice in their head. What voice, And the guy goes, if you're wondering what I'm talking about, it's that voice that just went, what voice? And I just spun around. Are you kidding me? That voice has been there my entire life. That's the voice that's been telling me, you know what, Michael? It's that bar you're drinking at and those people that are getting you in trouble. We need to go drink at another bar. Or it would be that voice that would tell me, you know what, Michael? You're more fun when you drink. Or that voice that would tell me, you know what, Michael? Tonight, we're just going to have one drink. That voice. That voice. And now you're telling me that you had that voice too. I couldn't believe it. And that voice got quiet that day. And I got comfortable that day, but I didn't follow it up with any action. I didn't read this big book that you guys had given me. I just returned to meetings, back of the meetings, arms folded, just looking at the ground, shaking my head, going, this isn't going to work. This isn't going to work, And I got to tell you, I came out of the closet when I was 16 years old, and I participated in rallies. I've held a sign that says, just because I'm gay, that doesn't make me any different than you. And then I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm like, hold on a second. I'm different than you guys are. You don't understand me. I'm different, right? And I remember, all this is going on in my head around this time, and I'm around 60 days sober, and this guy's sharing, right? And I don't remember what he said before this, but I certainly don't remember what he said after this. But what I heard him say that day is that this is Alcoholics Anonymous. And here, we look for the similarities and not the differences. Because when you start looking at the differences, you'll difference yourself right out that door. And the same program of Alcoholics Anonymous that worked for me is not going to work for you. And I heard that man that day. I heard him. And that voice got quiet that day. And I got a little bit comfortable. But again, I didn't follow it up with any action. I didn't call the sponsor that I had. Certainly didn't get into any of these steps. I just returned to the back of meetings, arms folded, just looking at the ground, shaking my head, going, this isn't going to work for me. This isn't going to work for me. And so by the time I'm 90 days sober, there's been no spiritual experience, no change that's sufficient enough to bring about recovery, and I'm going absolutely insane. I am going absolutely out of my mind, right? Because all I'm doing is I'm just sitting in meetings, shaking my head and not listening to you guys and not listening to what you guys are saying. And I'm not listening to the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what you guys are trying to tell me is that I suffer from this soul sickness, that I have this spiritual malady. And instead of treating it with the spiritual experience that's in the 12 steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been treating it with a synthetic experience that's an alcohol, and it's not sustainable. And so none of this is going on. I'm 90 days sober. I'm sitting in a meeting. There's no booze in me, and there's no recovery in me, and I have to go. I have to go. I have to drink. I don't have a choice anymore, right? And I'm taking this chip for 90 days. I stand up. I walk to the front. I grab the chip from the chip taker, and everybody's clapping like we do, going, oh, keep coming back. And I'm just like, to everybody, because it's just how I was. I just hated everybody. And not only did I hate everybody, I needed you to know that I hated you, so I had to hate you extra hard. It's a lot of work, but I was willing to put that work into it, And I'm walking back to my seat, and this little old woman, she stands up, she gets on my path, she puts her hands on my shoulder, she squeezes, she goes, you're the miracle. And I just wanted to punch her in the throat, I just wanted to get her right in that little windpipe and throw her on the ground. And I wanted to run. I wanted to run out of that meeting and drink, because that's the only thing that I knew to do to change the way that I felt inside. I didn't know any other way, And I remember I sat down and I was breathing heavily, my fists were clenched so tight, and this guy sitting next to me goes, bro, you gotta call your sponsor. And I'm like, I will throw punch you too, man. Just start with me. I'm a little guy. I'm a little guy. I go for the throat and try to get it out over with quick, you know? Rarely works. And I took the most contrary action that I had ever taken in my life up until that point. I did something that somebody else told me to do, and I called my sponsor. You know? And he answered the phone. And I begged him. I said, "You have got to change the way that I feel inside. I can't do this anymore." And my sponsor, you know, he didn't go, "Oh, who's this? Oh, I see your fingers work now that your life has fallen apart. You don't feel good." You know, he didn't, you know. My sponsor was a man who knew his responsibility in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is when the hand of a dying alcoholic reaches out and asks you for help, that you are the one that is responsible. And that man came over to my sober living that night, and he took me through steps 1, 2, and 3. And I'll never forget when he left me that night. Like, he looked in my eye. He looked right in my alcoholic soul, and he said, "Michael, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Go find God now." And I just love that line in chapter 5 that we read. You know, it's telling us when to find God. It's not telling us to find God next week. It's not telling us to find God when you're ready or after this meeting. It's telling us to find God now, because this is where God is in this present moment, right here, right now. And I did something that I hadn't done since I was a little boy that night. When I went to bed, I got down on my knees and I prayed. And I prayed to a God that I didn't have, but to a God that I desperately needed. And I said, "God, please, please, I will do anything. Just please keep me sober." At 90 days sober, I had no clue what I needed to do. But you guys, you good people of Alcoholics Anonymous, you showed me precisely what I needed to do. And my sponsor wasn't a guy who was like, "Okay, Michael, these are the 12 steps, and we're going to do this, this, and this, and that, that, and that." You know, he wasn't. You know, he brought a big book, and we sat down, and we read. I would read a little bit, and he would read a little bit. And when we got to a step, we'd work it. And it didn't take a long conversation to have me convinced that I had this insane relationship with alcohol. Do you know the pitiful and incomprehensible things that I have done just to take a drink? And the demoralizing things that I would continue to do, keep drinking. So it wasn't a long conversation. Like, I was convinced, you know? And then he asked me this question. He says, "Okay, Michael, do you now believe, or are you even willing to believe, that there was a power greater than yourself?" And I don't know. Like, we were going on 2 hours. I didn't know when we were finishing. It was late. I was bored. This was weird and awkward. And I just went, "Yeah, sure. Sure, I guess so." Yeah. I didn't know that tiny little amount of willingness was all that I needed to build this effective spiritual structure. I didn't know that. And just like that tiny amount of willingness is all that it takes to build a wonderfully effective spiritual structure, that tiny amount of unwillingness is all that it'll take to start unraveling that all down. So I have to stay willing in my sobriety today. I have to be willing to drive to Lancaster on Super Bowl Sunday. I have to. I have to stay willing. We kept reading. We got down on our knees, we said this prayer, sat back down, read a little bit more. We thought long and hard before taking this crucial step. And I'm like, "What step? What did we just do?" And he goes, "Okay, Michael, shiny object, back in the book, back in the mind." And I go, "Okay," you know, and I just keep reading, you know? We read until, you know, I read, you know, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, different principles and institutions with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry. You know, and he closed my book. He gave me a notepad and a pen. He goes, "Okay, Michael, now I want you to tell me everybody you're mad at and why." And I went, "Yes." Like, now I had, this is, okay, like, I love this now. Now I love this, right? Because I've been waiting my entire life for somebody to come up to me and go, "Michael, tell me everybody you're mad at and why." Like, I've been telling people my entire life anyways. I didn't need your consent, you know? And now somebody's giving me their consent. It was the greatest moment of my life, you know? And he would teach me things like integrity. He would go, "Okay, Michael, now when can you have that done by?" I'd be like, "I'll bang this out tonight and have it to you tomorrow." You know, and he'd go, "Okay, Michael, well, integrity, part of integrity is doing what we say when we say we are going to do it." No, it's okay. 5 days. 5 days. You know what I'm talking about, you know? And, and I'd call him 5 days later, and we'd get together, and we'd read a little bit more, and he would get me on the third column, and then the fourth column, and then we would do the fear inventory, and the sex inventory, and then the next thing I know, one Sunday morning, he picks me up, and he takes me to his house, and over the course of the next 5 hours, I begin to tell him the exact nature of my wrongs. And we begin to build a new me. A human being that's built on a foundation of spiritual principles. And if you're new, like, welcome. I welcome you. And, like, there's weird things. We do weird things. And you just got to go with it, right? You know, I remember one time, like, you know, I was new, like, still. And I'm standing outside of a meeting, and I'm smoking a cigarette because I smoked back then. And I was holding up a wall because that was cool. It was really cool, right? And this guy pulls up in his car, and he rolls his window down, and he goes, "Hey, you, work your third step and get in the car." And I start thinking to myself, okay, so do I work my third step and then get in his car, or do I get in his car and then work my third step? And, like, he's not my sponsor. Can I cross-sponsor like that? Is that like cars in the streams? And he's, like, seeing all this newcomer stuff bounce around in my head, and he goes, "Hey, kid, get in the car." Now, I should tell you at this point, when I was in the third grade, this cop came to our school, right? And he gathers all, like, in this assembly, kind of like this, right? And he tells us, he says, "I promise this is going to happen to one of you. One day a man is going to pull up in a car, he's going to roll his window down, and he's going to say, 'Hey, kid, get in the car.' And the only thing that you are to do is run, yell, and tell." And I froze. Like, I couldn't believe that it was happening to me. Like, there were 100 kids at that assembly that day, and it was happening to me. So I got in the car. We're driving for a little bit, and I'm like, "Man, where are you taking me?" He goes, "I'm taking you to an institution." And I'm like, I almost fucking roll out of this car, right? And he goes, "Relax, kid, relax. It's part of H&I. We're going to take a panel meeting into an institution that can't get out to a meeting." You know, and that's just what I started to do. I just started to get into the car, you know. I'd get into the car and we'd go hear your sponsor speak somewhere, you know. Or I'd get in the car and we'd go to a weekend big book workshop, you know. Or I'd get in the car and we'd go on a 12-step call. And then one day, I was about 5 months sober. I got in the car and it changed the course of my life. These guys were taking me up the mountain on this weekend AA retreat. And I shared this room with this guy named John. And I remember this. It was Saturday night. It was about 11:50 at night, and we're sitting on the edge of our beds, me and John, and we're talking. And I'm just so in awe of John at this night, because on this night, in 10 minutes, the stroke of midnight, John's gonna get 1 year sober. And, like, that was the coolest thing in the world to me. Like, you know, like, screw you guys with your 10s, your 15s, your 20 years sober, right? Like, that is unattainable to a guy like me at this point. But here, sitting right in front of me, is this guy, John, and he's about to get a year sober. And, like, I was, like, so amazed. And, like, I'm asking him all these questions. I'm like, "How do you feel? Do you feel any different? Where were you exactly 1 year ago today?" You know? And like, he's answering these questions. And I got quiet. I got quiet and I got scared. Because I wanted an answer to a question that I had for a while. And I just took a deep breath and I mustered enough courage to ask him. And I said, "Hey, John, do you think that I can get 1 year sober?" And John thought about that for a moment. You know, he kind of stroked his goatee a little bit and he says, "Well," he says, "you know, I'm just doing what the guys before me have done. So I suppose if you do what I do, and I keep doing what they do, then yeah, you'll get 1 year sober too." Do you hear what John told me that night? What John told me that night is that if you do what I do, you'll live. If you do what I do, you will live. Can you say that to a newcomer? Are you living your life in a way that you could tell a newcomer, "Do what I do and you'll live"? Because John was. John was absolutely living his life in a way that he could tell a newcomer, me, "Do what I do and you'll live." So I did. I followed John everywhere. I did exactly what John was doing. And as it turns out, John was just doing five things. Number one, John was going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Number two, John had commitments at those meetings. Number three, John had a sponsor. Number four, John was working his steps with that sponsor. Number five, and most importantly, John was trying to help other alcoholics. And by doing those five things, what ended up happening was I was living my life in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. As long as I have those five things going on in my life today, and I do, I always keep those five things going on. Biggest thing in my life today is I've got a 6.5-year-old nephew. You know, my sister and I were really close, and she's a single woman. She did IVF years ago, and I helped her raise him, and he and I are really close. I was there in the room when he was hatched. She had a C-section. He was hatched. I've told him that. I'm telling him that for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, you know. And I remember I just kept peeking over that curtain, and I saw them raise him out, and I just hooked my eyes on him, and just like that, I fell in love with the human being that I love more than myself, you know. And he and I are really close. I see him just about every day, and he's really into dinosaurs. A few years ago, I took him to this Jurassic Quest exhibit where they have these like life-size dinosaurs and they're on animatronics and stuff like that. And we're going through, and I'm carrying him. I'm carrying him. God, I used to be able to. And we're going through this maze part, right? And we get to this bridge that we have to cross to get outside. And I can see outside. I could see outside, right? But on the other side of these bridges are these velociraptors, and they're just snapping at you and stuff like that. And he's holding on to me like with a death grip, right? And he looks at me and goes, "Uncle, I'm scared." And I go, "I know you are, little buddy, but I can see the other side. You're going to be okay." And I just walked us across the bridge, you know? And that's my relationship with God today. I let God carry me wherever I go. And when I get scared, I just hold on to God really tight. And I say, "God, I'm scared." And God goes, "I know you are, little buddy, but I can see the other side, and you're going to be okay." And he walks me across that bridge, you know. And I never know what's on the other side until God carries me there. A couple years ago, I left a career of mine of about a decade, and I was being recruited by somebody to go and work for their company. And it's really important in my life today, in my sobriety today, that I be where God wants me to be, that I be where God needs me to be. I reflected on this, and I thought really hard about this, and I prayed and I meditated on it, and it seemed like this is where God wanted my life to go, and he had offered me a lot of money to go work for him, and so I did. I left my career and I went to work for him, and it became really clear about 2 weeks in that I may have been guided by those zeros behind my salary, because I had boarded a sinking ship, and I began to seek God in everything, and okay, God, what are we doing here? What do you want me to do? What are we doing, man? Because in my life it's like I gotta have faith and reliance in God, right? I can have all the faith in the world, but if I'm making little plans on the side just in case this, you know, I don't like God's plan here, you know, then I'm relying on self. So, you know, I put my full faith and reliance in God, and I just, you know, every morning I'd be like, you know, okay, God, what do you want me to do? What are we doing here? About 4 months later, I was laid off, and they laid me off with a really, really nice severance package, and a really generous one, it really would have paid the bills and allowed me to be fine for, you know, 3 to 4 months, and it was just really weird, and I had plans with a friend of mine. This was a friend I get, you know, who had 38 years sober, and we would meet once a month, and we had plans, and I couldn't get a hold of him. And I was not like him, I started like looking for him, and I found him in the hospital. I found him, you know, on this weekend that they had discovered a tumor in his brain the size of a softball, and I found him on the weekend that the that they gave him the news that there was nothing that they could do. And I found him on the weekend when he made the decision that he wanted to go home and live the rest of his life. And it became overwhelmingly clear where God had taken me in that moment. I took him home I spent every day with him. I took care of him, and it's not something that I wanted to do. I didn't like it. I every morning I would wake up and I would just go, what do you want me to do? Please help me, God, you know. And I would go to his place in the morning, and my late great sponsor Don B, you know, he used to talk about, you know, that God's will is duty at the present moment, you know. And sometimes, you know, God's will was feeding, making food for my friend. Sometimes God's will was painting his nails black like he loved. Sometimes God's will was just stroking his forehead and thanking him for his life. You know, this was a man who had given me great, great spiritual guidance over my 16 years sober, and this was a man who taught me that I have a duty in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a soldier for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and he taught me that I and we all have a duty in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I think about that duty, I think of Sam Shoemaker's poem, I Stand at the Door. Because in it, he talks about how I neither stay too far in nor go too far outside. Right? And Sam talks about in this poem how this door is the most important door in the world because it's the door that blind men and women go through when they find God. And how the most important job any one of us can do is stand outside this door and take the hand of those outstretched, blind, groping hands and place it on the latch, which only opens to their touch, and they find God. At 90 days sober, I begged you to change the way that I felt inside. And you good people of Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing full well that no human power could have relieved me of my alcoholism, you took me by the hand and you placed me in the loving arms of a God of my own understanding. And for that, I will walk the ends of the earth for Alcoholics Anonymous. Mark, thank you so much. Lancaster, thank you all. I love you. Thank you.